Hi, and welcome to another Cyber Podcasts episode. I'm your host, Christoph Limpler, and in this episode, Shane Sims joins us for a second episode. Shane's already been on the podcast before, and after recording the last episode, he mentioned that he had infiltrated a hacker group and wore a wire. And so naturally, we had to talk about that and record a second episode. And so here we are. If you haven't listened to the prior episode with Shane, I'll just give you a really quick intro. He is the CEO of Kivu, which is a full-service cybersecurity consulting firm. Before that, he spent a number of years at KPMG and PwC, and he also spent 11 years at the FBI leading a cyber offense team. Now, I have not heard this specific story before of how he infiltrated the cybercrime group, and so I'm learning about it as we're recording this, and I think it's going to be super, super interesting. So let's get into it. Shane, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Take us back to set the stage for a minute here. First of all, what time frame are we talking about? When did this story take place?
This happened, I want to say, a few years after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. So we'll call it 2005-ish. Really, as cybercrime was starting to mature, criminals were getting more organized and they were getting more targeted in terms of what they were trying to accomplish.
So about 2005, and are you able to share information about what the cybercrime group name was, right? We have a lot of groups today that have code names. What was the code name of this group?
You know, oddly, this group did not have a moniker like a lot of them did at the time and still do today. They were organized, but no official name, and they really weren't looking for attention or bragging about their activities.
So they weren't looking for attention, yet they still work their way onto your radar and across your desk. Can we start off by talking a little bit more about that process? And I don't know if it's changed since then, right? That was back in 2005. But at that point in time, how did the FBI get involved with a group like this, especially a group that wasn't trying to get fame or get a lot of attention? How do they prioritize what threats to go after considering that I'm sure they get a lot of reports probably on a daily basis, and some of them are probably not legitimate while others are. How do they figure that out? How do they figure out what to go after?
So in this particular case, we were receiving complaints from local businesses. There was a person and a group of people supporting this person that were extorting companies, or at least it felt like extortion, different form of extortion than what we see in the cybercrime world today. But in essence, the complaints were related to getting a phone call advising the company that they had accessed sensitive information and that they were looking for some form of payment to not expose the information further. So to the companies that were receiving the phone call, it did not feel like a security service. It certainly felt like crime and extortion.
And are you referring to intellectual property data that they had found or accessed, or are you referring to a vulnerability? For example, maybe they found a weakness in their services, and they said, "Hey, if you don't hire us to fix this, then we'll expose you." What did that look like?
That was pretty much it. So I think the complaint that got my attention of the few that we had that were coming in short succession was a very well-known brand. It was primarily a defense contractor, right? They're a member of the defense industrial base, manufacturing parts for the military. When we got that one, it started to become a lot more serious. But their primary method, based on the complaints that we had, was that they were exploiting vulnerabilities in wireless access points to gain access to the corporate network, and then leveraging that foothold to determine what information was available to them. And it was a little bit different for each of the initial complaints. For instance, at one of the smaller companies, these guys had accessed the entire payroll database. So, you know, they had very sensitive information of key corporate executives and key employees. And that's, you know, when you're receiving a phone call like that, it's pretty unnerving.
Absolutely. And just a quick note to self, don't go after a defense contractor. That's a sure way of getting on the FBI's radar. But
not a good move.
Definitely not a good move. They probably could have picked their targets a little bit better. And this could be an interesting conversation for another day too, but it kind of reminds me of the whole situation. Obviously, this is very different from this, but we've seen situations where you have security researchers that may have found an issue, a vulnerability, a weakness, anything of that sort or nature in a system, and they may have reached out to the organization as a way of trying to help them fix it. But then the organization gets super defensive and they're like, you know, what are you doing? That's against our terms of service. Don't do that again, or we'll pursue you legally. Of course, that's not always the response that you get. And this situation is very different, but it kind of reminds me of that too. You've got a very narrow line that you have to walk when you're dealing with situations like that. And not taking it further if you do end up finding a vulnerability that you could exploit, knowing when to stop and knowing when to step back and say, all right, I found something pretty big here. Let me reach out to the organization and inform them of that issue and then not actually try to actively exploit it. There's a very big difference there for sure.
Yeah, just to summarize that a little bit more, I mean, identifying a vulnerability and reporting that to companies or to government agencies today it's a little more lax than it was 20 years ago. But what hasn't changed is if you make the decision to knowingly and voluntarily exploit the vulnerability to gain unauthorized access to a system, in that moment, you have violated Title 18, Section 1030 of U.S. Code, right? It's still technically a federal crime.
And that's a lot more specific than I could have said it. So yeah, great summary. Thank you.
I was testing my memory, so I appreciate it.
I'm impressed. I would definitely have to look that up. Okay, so it came across your desk. You had received complaints. They went after a defense contractor. They were potentially trying to exploit these organizations. And so how do you, like, what happens after that when you realize, you know what, this is a threat that we need to take seriously and that we need to look into? What are the next steps after that?
That it was challenging, right? These guys weren't publicly known, sort of felt like research, but was technically a crime. Traditional investigative techniques weren't going to get us too far. So, you know, I proposed an undercover operation up the chain of command as a way to better understand if there was evidence that these guys were, you know, committing crimes or not. I mean, at that time, myself and many, many other special agents, and even today, agents that investigate cybercrime, you know, they conduct thousands and thousands and thousands of online undercover activity. But at this time, it would become the first face-to-face traditional undercover operation in a cybercrime matter. So the approvals were granted, and then things started to move forward. So the first thing, you know, you have to do in a traditional undercover operation is you have to identify who in the bureau is going to be the undercover agent or agents that will be doing the face-to-face contact with the subjects of the investigation. So that was an initial challenge. And then once you identify those agents, they have to be fully backstopped. So they have to have completely different names and backgrounds and histories and addresses and phone numbers and employment histories. That all takes time to put together. And it has to be extremely thorough, because in most undercover operations, at some point, the subjects are going to challenge the people they're interacting with, challenge their backgrounds. They're going to assume that maybe this person that's come into their lives might be in law enforcement. So they're going to probe hard. And the backstopping's got to be there. It's got to be solid. And that's something the FBI does really well. In this particular case, the requirements that I laid out for the agents did not exist in the Bureau. I remember, you know, coming out of the FBI Academy, I was single. I had said goodbye to a company that I founded as the CEO. And I just decided I was all in, right? I'm going to learn as much as I can. I'm going to do, you know, whatever I'm asked to do, except I'll never work undercover. So here we are at this crossroads. There's no trained undercover agents that meet the requirements of this particular case. And as it turns out, I did. So I became the primary undercover agent. Had all the backstopping. So, you know, basically I was posing as a businessman in Chicago, right? I had a apartment in a high rise. I had a fancy car. I had a company and an office in the suburbs of Chicago. And I was traveling to this other city where the subjects were on a periodic basis to visit clients and to network with competitors, and had been introduced to them by a mutual acquaintance who we developed as a source who would make that first introduction. And that's really how it got started, right? It took some time to get going because the backstopping takes weeks to months, and the approvals, getting the, you know, U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Venue on board with it, that all took probably 3 to 6 months before first contact.
I can only imagine how many approvals something like this has to go through. And like you said, the preparation and also the number of hours that you'd have to go through to get trained on something like this. And it's funny, I was internally laughing when you said I would have done anything but being undercover. I can think of probably a dozen off the top of my head reasons why I would never personally want to be undercover. But what were some of your hesitations or reservations going into this?
Well, just, you know, did I have the personality type to pull this off? That was questionable. Did I have the ability to think on my feet when things didn't go as planned, and they never do? How would I handle, you know, the situation when it would inevitably come up, when I would be challenged on who I was? You know, was I going to be able to perform like a, you know, could I give an Oscar-worthy performance as an actor? Basically, you know, which is what undercover work requires, right? You're basically acting. So I got my first test, right, at our first meeting, which was in the city where these guys lived. And the meeting got set up by the third party that knew these guys and allegedly knew me. And so we met at a hotel room. It was one of these hotel rooms where you've got a connecting room. In the connecting room, there were other agents. We had the other side of the wall. You know, there were microphones and cameras embedded over there. And of course, they were my security team as well, if something were to go wrong. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're in there, we're talking, just initial introductions, right? Who I am, my background, why I'm in town, what I do. Started to plant some seeds that, you know, perhaps I was a corrupt businessman and looking to make money in other ways. Didn't get too far down that road in the first meeting, but just sort of planted the seeds. I remember in that meeting, I was sitting on a couch and I had my backup weapon of the time was a Glock 27, which is some people refer to that as a baby Glock, you know. I had it on my ankle and I happened to notice that my pant leg had risen up quite a bit and the gun was exposed, but somehow the guy I was meeting with didn't notice it. And for whatever reason, I didn't panic. I just sort of moved my foot around till the pant leg dropped. But that was that was the first sort of pucker factor that I had in an undercover case.
I'm getting stressed out and I wasn't even there. this is like a scene out of a movie. So to make sure I've got this right, when you were first introduced, were you introduced as a potential target or were you introduced as a potential collaborator with this group?
As a collaborator.
Okay, gotcha. So you were meeting to see if or to check your backstory, make sure that you would be a good fit. And that gave you the opportunity to plant the seed that you would potentially be interested in collaborating with this group to then turn around and try to extort some of the other organizations, right?
Yeah, if I recall correctly, I was interested in meeting them through this intermediary because of what the intermediary had told me were some skills they had that I did not have or no one at my company had. And it was really about their ability to identify vulnerabilities in technology. Didn't get into what we were going to do, what the real interest was at that time, but it was more that first hotel meeting was just introductions. And then we continued the contact for, I'd say, 6 to 8 weeks by phone. So once a week, having phone contact, those contacts were recorded. And we sort of furthered the relationship by phone for a couple months before the next meeting.
And at what point were you able to collect the enough evidence to be able to stop the investigation or proceed to the next step, which is, you know, sentencing or whatever else you were trying to do with that?
Yeah, we're a few moves away from that at this point. So one of the next meetings, after we started developing rapport, like I encouraged them to like show me how they find these vulnerabilities in wireless networks and how they gain access. And so we met back in their city and we're downtown, rolling around in their Range Rover, and they had, you know, a bunch of laptops in there and all these weird antennas, like omnidirectional antennas, directional antennas. And they ended up parking on the street at this city park, and they pointed towards the skyscraper and said, "So there's a bunch of law firms in that skyscraper over there. So this is one method." So they pull out this antenna. It looked like, you know, a Pringles can, but three times as long. Sort of stuck it out of their window and aimed it at that building. And on their laptop, all of a sudden, you know, they had this software that would identify all the wireless networks. So they just picked one, you know, law firm X. They ran their little script to identify if the wireless access point was vulnerable. It was. And they ran their program to gain access, and they did. And then they showed me some things that they could do. So at that point, they had committed their first crime with me while wearing a wire. So everything that they were doing was being recorded. And anytime I met with these guys face to face and we were mobile like that, there were, you know, other agents in other cars for security, but also I wore a separate transmitter so they could listen live to you know, the conversation. And in every one of those situations, we had a code word. So if I were to, you know, drop the code word, those guys would, you know, roll up and save the day, so to speak. So that was a pretty significant meeting. Happy to pause there, but there's probably a few more that you want to hear about.
I'm curious to hear more about those because, I mean, if you're thinking about it, right, you've got the first crime recorded on tape, but how do you decide whether to call the operation at this point or to keep going and try to get even more evidence or extract further information before calling it quits?
Yeah, it took another probably 2 to 3 months of phone calls and in-person meetings where we really wanted to, you know, gather evidence that these guys knew what they were doing, right? That they weren't just technically violating the law by gaining unauthorized access, but, you know, they were going in there with an objective, which they were, to steal information, to serve some other purpose, which was financial gain, you know, personal financial gain, but also just to confirm through evidence and wearing the wire that, you know, these guys knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily were committing crimes. And then I also wanted to just rule out any defense around entrapment. You know, entrapment kind of goes like this. If a government official coerces somebody to commit a crime that they wouldn't otherwise commit, that would be entrapment. So I wanted to get that off the table and probably spent more time and more interactions than I needed to do that. And that became obvious in one particular face-to-face meeting where we were driving around again and they were targeting an organization and again, technically committed the crime. And I was really pressing these guys like, this is criminal and I hope you guys know that. And, but you know, you're not getting caught 'cause you're super, super talented. Because
you're so good and you don't get caught, I think I want to hire you to do a job for me.
Mm.
But before I tell you what it is, I want to tell you, it's if we get caught, we're going to jail. So there was no defense around any of this, right? So talked about what the objective was of the target. Didn't talk about what I was going to pay them. I just wanted them to see if they would, you know, without hesitation, agree to commit this crime. And the target in this particular case was going to be another, what they believed to be a government contractor in a completely different state in another part of the U.S. And then I asked them, like, what would you charge? So I didn't dangle the carrot, right? I let these guys tell me what they wanted. And to complete the mission, they wanted $100,000. So all this is on, you know, on wire with other agents and cars listening and witnessing. And then after we agreed to do it, we went for a drive. I can't remember where we went, somewhere somewhat remote. And as we were getting more remote, I was getting a little bit more nervous about, you know, is my surveillance team going to be able to hang here? And can they hear the transmissions? Because I was really starting to think about that keyword and whether or not I'd be saying that word. But they took me somewhere and they really started pressing me on my background. And I had told them I was from some other city in some other state, not Chicago. I grew up over here, not there. And they had done their homework. Like, it was a sort of a small town. And they asked me things like, you know, what was your favorite pizza parlor in this town? Like, how many movie theaters were in the town?
Oh, wow.
And it's, you know, it gets a little hairy because, you know, you go in and you're thinking these are cyber criminals, these, you know, white collar criminals. And one thing that I recall from the FBI Academy is that, you know, the instructors there did a really good job of driving home the reality that the really, really violent criminals have been to jail before. And they're not afraid to go back. In fact, jail life might be a better life for some of these fools. But white-collar criminals do not want to go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And they could get violent in like the snap of a finger if they thought they were going to go to jail. And, you know, they ingrained that in our heads at the FBI Academy, not just through classroom discussion, but through, you know, practical applications at Hogan's Alley where you went through these real-life scenarios. So here I am in this situation, thinking about all this, but I passed their test, answered all their questions, thanks to really good backstopping. We agreed to proceed with the plan that we had talked about. There were a few more meetings in person in their hometown, and then we all traveled to the destination where this next target was.
So not only do you have to have excellent backstories and know all the facts, like if somebody asks you such a detailed question of how many movie theaters are in this town that you grew up in, which obviously you should be able to know if it's a really small town, not only do you have to have that under wraps and you have to be a really good actor, you also have to have the technical background, because otherwise they wouldn't buy the story if you didn't understand how some of these devices worked or have the ability to ask questions about it. I feel like a technical person of their ability would be able to sniff that out really quickly. So you have to find an agent that is able to check all of those boxes. That's really quite incredible and amazing that, you know, that person ended up being you. Obviously you had a very thorough training, but also a lot of technical background, right?
Yeah. And that was part of the challenge of finding an experienced undercover agent, was that we just couldn't find somebody who checked all the boxes. And the gap that kept coming up was, you know, the technical background and knowledge, understand what these guys were saying. And then more importantly, to be able to present that to prosecutors in a courtroom if needed, and to do it in a clear way that attorneys and jurors would understand. So that was certainly my background before the FBI. So it made a lot of sense. But at that meeting where we introduced the concept of them performing a job and them proposing a fee for the job, I had introduced a second undercover agent with me. This guy did have a ton of experience working undercover. And what we were to do this as a team, right? Because I didn't know where this was going and I didn't want to be alone anymore. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be outside of the transmission radius of the devices I was wearing. And these guys are starting to make me nervous. So I introduced a second guy, and then we all traveled down to the southwest of the U.S. To do the dirty deed. Talk about that a little bit if you want as well.
Let's definitely do that. I know you have a hard stop coming up here in about, I think, 8 minutes or so, and I want to be respectful of that. But let's go ahead and move on to that next step where now you have the evidence and you're able to take the next step. What does that look like?
Yeah. Yeah. And I can go over a little bit here. So there we are. We're set up in a hotel room, the biggest, fanciest hotel in this city. It has line of sight to a big skyscraper in the city. And in the skyscraper is a defense contractor that's working on missile technology. So, you know, they get set up in the hotel room, get out their antennas, go through their routine. They had a little bit of trouble. They found the wireless network easily. They had a little bit of trouble gaining access, but ultimately did. They downloaded, like, you know, at that time, this was a lot, but about 700 megabytes of what they believed to be, you know, very sensitive, potentially government information. And they get it on their laptops, and they told my partner and I, they said, look, we're going to encrypt this information. We're going to put it on an external drive. We will meet you back in our home city in 1 week at this hotel. And then in exchange for the $100,000 in cash, we'll give you the decryption key. So we all left. They were pretty happy. They accomplished their mission. They knew they had a payday coming. And that led us to, you know, the last interaction in the undercover op. We're in this hotel room. We had been there most of the day setting up. They had rented a room. We had to have people nearby. We didn't know how this was going to go. We were able to get a room actually right next door, which was fortunate. So again, that the subject's room was all wired up with sound and video. We had a SWAT team next door that was going to do the arrest should this happen. Again, I had a code word. If I dropped the code word, the SWAT team would come in. Pretty simple. Whether I was nervous or scared or because we actually finished the deal and we wanted to make the arrest. So the subjects arrive. They give us the decryption key. They show us how to use it. We get access to all this information about missile technology. I dump the money out on the bed out of a small bag. $100K. It's not, you'd be surprised. It's not that much. Even in 10s, 20s, and 50s, it doesn't take up a lot of space. But so anyway, it's on the bed. They're taking it. They're splitting it up. They're discussing who's going to get what. They're putting it in their own bags. I say, all right, guys, this was great. Let's talk about the next one. And they proposed gaining access to a baggage system at the international airport in that city. That they had done it before and they could do it again. And we could make a lot of money off that. And I knew we had enough at this point. Could have continued on, could continue to pile on from a charges perspective, but I dropped the code word. So I said, guys, let's pause on all that and go get a Guinness. So Guinness was the code word. As soon as I said Guinness, somebody beat the door down. And the SWAT team came in. They arrested the subjects. They arrested me, and they arrested my partner. And we all get taken out in handcuffs, put in cars, and boom, back to the local FBI office for interrogation. So that was the official end of the thing. They did get charged with crimes. They were sentenced. And eventually, they found out that I was an FBI agent, which was an interesting meeting at the U.S. Attorney's office the moment they found that out. I've never seen a human being turn pale white, but I did that day.
I was about to ask you how they responded or reacted to that once they finally realized who you were and what had happened.
Well, just to give you a quick blurb there. So, you know, all the quote unquote subjects are reporting to the U.S. Attorney's Office to work out a plea deal in return for not having to present this in court, save the taxpayers time and money. That process is called an information. So as long as they, you know, admitted to what they did, we would do this quietly, right, without a lot of courtroom drama. So I'm in the waiting room, and, you know, one of the subjects shows up, and he's like, "Hey, so-and-so, I guess we're all here for the same reason." I said, "Yeah, I think we are, and it's unfortunate." And then we get called into this conference room, and, you know, the assistant U.S. attorneys that are going to prosecute the case are in there, and we're sitting around a conference table. And this is just one of the subjects is in there at this time. And he looks over at me and says, "Hey, have you properly introduced yourself?" I said, "I haven't." And he said, "Well, could you do that now?" So I'm in a suit. I take out my credentials, which has a badge on it as well, and I slide it across the table to subject one. And he opens it up and just, like, I've never seen a human being literally lose all the blood in their face. So anyway, it was a pretty cool ending. Felt really bad for the guy in that moment, but it was a successful case.
Probably one of the worst days of his life, that's for sure.
No doubt.
I had a quick question and then we'll wrap up. When you were talking about going remotely to that meeting so that they could perform the quote-unquote job that you had hired them to do, was that meeting set up by you, or was that a legitimate meeting that the defense contractor didn't even realize this was happening at?
They had no clue.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you had done your homework. You knew that meeting was going to happen, and it was all part of the plan.
Well, as it turns out, that defense contractor was also a backstopped government business.
It was gotcha. Okay.
Not a real defense contractor. So
it was all planted information, wasn't actually. Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.
And to your point, feeling like a Hollywood movie, the whole thing felt like that. I mean, everything we did was planned out, scripted. The script never went 100%, right? There was always some ad-libbing and ad-hocking, but in many, many regards, it was almost like developing a movie.
I'm impressed. I mean, it just sounds so planned out, so meticulous, so detailed, and obviously took a lot of skill from an elite team, right? That's obviously got experience doing things like that. So yeah, really impressive. And on that note, to wrap up really quickly here, if you have somebody listening and they're hearing this story and they go, "Wow, I want to do that. I want to be part of a team that does something like this," what would be your parting advice in terms of skills or just career paths that they could take to follow those footsteps and do something like this?
Well, law enforcement at all levels are constantly looking for people with technical backgrounds and skills. Depending on the agency, you know, they all have different entrance requirements, from, you know, education requirements to experience requirements. But they're all looking. They all need help. Cybercrime's not going to go away ever. It's only going to get worse. The velocity of it continues to outpace the security defenses and the talent pool that's out there today. So it's a really good time. Like, if you're interested in doing this kind of work and leveraging your technical background.
Shane, thank you so much for your time. And I'm so glad that we're able to do this second episode. I'm glad you were able to mention that last time. If you have any more stories up your sleeve like this, feel free to reach back out. I'm happy to record these all day, every day. This is fascinating to me. But if anybody wants to follow up with you or with your organization and connect, how do you recommend that they do that?
I recommend going to kivuconsulting.com, KIVUconsulting.com. All of our contact information is available there. And we're a 24/7 business with people located in the US and the UK. So always available.
And last time we spoke, you mentioned that you had some open positions for hire. So if anybody's interested, definitely check those out as well. It wasn't that long ago, so I'm sure that's probably still the case. And just go to kivu.com for either consulting or potential job opportunities and positions. But yeah, Shane, thank you so much for coming back. Really appreciate it. I had a great time, and I hope you did as well.
My pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.